Matthew is known as Matthew, the tax collector. But also in Luke, he's known as Matthew Levi. And I wonder if Matthew always had a particular streak in him. When Jacob was dying and he wanted to bless each of his 12 rather rambunctious sons, actually, and two grandsons by that time, by the time he was dying. But talking about Simeon and Levi, who were brothers, he says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. They are weapons of violence, are their swords. May I never come into their council. May I not be joined to their company. For in their anger, they killed men, and at their whim, they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Talk about having daddy issues. You like your dad to say that about you on your deathbed, but he did not forget. He didn't forget the incident that Matthew and Levi read when they killed everybody who they believed was responsible for the kidnapping and the rape of their little sister. But Matthew may have had this streak in him. He lived in the Galilee, and he was second class, never enough. And when you're oppressed by a power of this world, you have desire for power. You want it. And there's no Jewish man in the first century who had to look too far to find real power. The power, that power, had occupied Judah oppressively now for 170 years. It began as a little village on the banks of the Tiber River in a myth about Remus and Romulus and the she-wolf. And in just a few years, they grew to rule the world exactly as Daniel said that it would happen. Legs of iron that smash everything they come in contact with. Iron teeth that devour anyone who gets in the way. And oh, by the way, after their 170 years up until Matthew's day, they're going to rule the world for 600 more. They did it like no empire before or since. It was a smart, shrewd, but ruthless system. They simply came in and made it theirs. As long as you didn't put up too much of a struggle, it could be done rather quietly. They made all architecture that they found theirs. Greek architecture became Roman architecture. They even took their mythology and just changed the gods' names to Roman names. Every now and then, though, they'd make a statement. Like during the occupation of Jerusalem in 70 AD, when the Kidron Valley was filled with so many crucified Hebrew patriots that you could not walk with your arms outstretched amongst them. They called it Pax Romana. The peace of Rome. Sure, it was peaceful because everybody was terrified. They were scared to death. Caesar only asked two things of you. Two things to keep me from absolutely crushing you. One is that you would pay your taxes. Whatever tax I say, that you would pay your taxes. Two is, you will not rebel against me or my throne. If you did that, you pretty much could live like you always did. And it worked so well that by Matthew's day, the Mediterranean was a Roman lake. It worked so well that they came to rule the known civilized world. I say that it worked so well, except in one little place. Israel. Palestine was a constant thorn in the side of the empire. Countries 10 times the size of Israel could be controlled with one garrison, with one Roman fort. In this little place that takes up less space than Vermont and New Hampshire, they needed 9 garrisons, 9 fortified cities to keep the peace. In this land, this tiny little land of these stupid, stubborn, backwater people,
The ones that claim to only worship one God. One God. The Senate constantly laughed at them of how backwards they were. And by the way, when you believe that that one God has a particular interest in you, and that your money, especially your tax money, belongs to that God, rebellion is always on the horizon in a place like that. So you had to decide, as a Jewish man, you had to decide, as an Israeli living in that time, where do you want your citizenship to be? Who do you want to be known as loyal to? The real power of the world? Or those scrappy, tough little rebels that ascended from Abraham's kids, trying to be powerful, but never seeming to be able to do it? Matthew, we don't know when, decided it would be Rome. He gave up his given Hebrew name of Levi, and he took on Matthias, a Roman Greek name of origin. Matthew Levi knows what real power is, and he wanted to be on the inside. Publicans were public contractors. That's how they got their name. The role they often supplied the Roman legions and the military was by collecting of port duties and oversaw public building projects. In addition, they served as tax collectors for the Republic and later the Roman Empire. They bid on contracts that came from the Senate and for the collection of various types of taxes. Importantly, this role as tax collectors was not emphasized until late into the history of the Republic, just around the first century BCE. The publicans were a class of equites, second only of the property classes below the Senate. This is the reason that Matthew concerned mainly, I believe, when he wrote his gospel, after being born again, after meeting Jesus on the sea that day and being called to be his follower. I think when he writes his gospel, this is the reason that he wants to write for a Jewish audience. He spent his entire adult life betraying his people as a publican, as a Roman tax collector. He would naturally want to reach them with this gospel after he was found by this Jewish Messiah. Matthew's gospel relies upon Israel scriptures more than any other early Christian text. Approximately 50 quotations and allusions to the New Testament, to the Old Testament, especially the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. What's unique to Matthew's gospel? Constantly referring, constantly talking about the kingdom of heaven. He spent his entire life serving the kingdom of this world. He wanted his brothers and sisters to know that there was a kingdom beyond Rome's reach. That there was a kingdom that we belong to. And we belong to now, no matter who's sitting on Caesar's throne. The scribes, the priests, the religious leaders pored over the books and prophecies of Daniel and Ezekiel, hundreds of references to the coming Messiah. They experienced captivity and occupation, all at the hands of these world's powers. Nebuchadnezzar, the Ptolemies, the Seleucids, Caesar, finally, and it gave them an idea. The writings give them the idea of what the kingdom of heaven would look like. So when they hear these words come out of Jesus' mouth, it wakes them all up just a little bit. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. For that time, Jesus began to proclaim, repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. Later on, he tells his disciples, as you go, proclaim the good news. And the good news has one component. The kingdom of heaven is near. Kingdom of heaven is at hand. See, these words quicken the pulse of a people ready for David, ready for Solomon, ready for Moses, ready for anybody that will do something about that man sitting on that throne. While we languish under his thumb. So every time he speaks of the kingdom, it stirs memories. Bright banners, glittering armies, the gold and ivory of Solomon's day, the nation of Israel restored. And every time that they believed that that's the kingdom he was talking about, he would truly look them in the eye and say, "You ain't seen nothing yet. If you think that is what the kingdom is, you ain't seen nothing yet." I'm paraphrasing, but he did say that. He actually said, "Truly, I tell you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see, but did not see it and did not hear it. But you see it and you hear it." He then said, "The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to listen to the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed something greater than Solomon is here at hand." Zealots who stand at the edge of Jesus' audience right now, armed and well-organized guerrilla fighters, spoiling for a fight against Rome. But to their consternation, the signal for revolt never came from this king. Jesus' behavior begins to disappoint everyone looking for King David. Everyone looking for God's answer to Roman power. Didn't seem to be this country rabbi from Galilee. He was attracted to the weak, not the power. He was attracted to the minority, not the majority, who has all the power. He insulted the memory of Israel's glory days. He compared King Solomon to a daylily. The one time that the crowd decided that they were going to make him king, disappeared. He mysteriously withdraws. And then when Peter finally does wield a sword on his behalf, Jesus tells him to put it away and he heals his victim's wounds. To the crowd's dismay, it became clear that Jesus was talking about a different power, a strange kingdom, a different kind of power being wielded by God on his throne. Judeans wanted what people always have from a visible kingdom. They wanted their own vine and fig tree, full employment, a strong army to deter invaders. But Jesus announces a kingdom that meant denying yourself, taking up a cross, renouncing wealth, and loving your enemies. And as he elaborated, the crowd's expectations crumble and the crowds begin to dwindle. So much so that one day, after feeding them miraculously for 2 days, they all left. And all that's left is Matthew and his friends. To where Jesus even has to ask, "You don't want to leave me too, do you?" Jesus never offered a clear definition or description of the kingdom of heaven. But one thing I can tell you about it is that it isn't here. That's the one thing I can tell you about the kingdom. It isn't here. This ain't it. And to say that the kingdom of this world is the opposite of the kingdom of heaven, that's almost selling it short. Jesus speaking of the kingdom of heaven confuses us because we live amidst this power. We live in the same kind of world powers and conflicts that plague them. It plagues us, and it will continue to do so until he comes back and does finally something about it. But he said, "If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same?" I always wondered what that felt like. For the one tax collector in the group to hear him be singled out that way. "The Son of Man came eating and drinking." They said, "Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by her needs." "Which one of the two did the will of his father?" he says. They said, "The first." Jesus said that, "I say to you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes will get into the kingdom before you." Chapter 21, he says, "For John came to you in the way of righteousness that you did not believe in, but the tax collectors and the prostitutes did believe him. And you, seeing this, did not even feel remorse afterwards so as to believe him." So Matthew finds himself at this table. He'd lounged at tables before. Rome knows how to party. He's lounged at them his entire adult life. He laid at the table of power. He's been there. But now he finds himself at this one. After this little country rabbi with this strange message talking about this strange kingdom that isn't here, after he sits with them at the table. It happened as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house. Many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with him and his disciples. The Pharisees, the self-righteous, the religious leaders see this and they say, "Why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and the sinners?" He'll add a few chapters later, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you lock people out of the kingdom of heaven, for you do not go in yourselves, and when others are going in, you stop them." See, it isn't that there is good and evil people based on merit. Jesus points out that the problem is the professed church didn't see themselves in the sinners that Jesus was reclining with, that he was eating with at this table. Becoming more like Christ has been viewed, becoming more like God in their day, and for us today, becoming more like Christ is viewed as meritorious. In other words, a good religious life merits the kingdom. And when people believe that, they make other people stumble. We actually believe that partaking in a worthy manner means we better have been good all week before we came here to make sure that we belong at this table. Matthew knows different. He walked away from his tax collector's booth. Not quite sure he had a whole lot of time to repent of his former ways. Not quite sure he had any time to live a better life, to become better. And he finds himself sitting at the table with the first time that a rabbi ever dared to walk in to this place. Remember, the rabbis taught they couldn't even come in. Notice, the Pharisees and the self-righteous people are standing outside because they're taught that inside there is unclean. And notice, there are some of his disciples who are staying out there too. I wonder if Matthew expected Jesus to beg off and say, "You know, I'd love to sit with you, Matthew, but you know I can't come in there." So that when Jesus sits down and begins to eat and drink with him, I believe this is the moment. This is the moment where Matthew wonders about his alter ego. Worst of sinners, a servant of the oppressors of his own people, the tax collector, sits alone at the top of the sin pyramid in their eyes. One who sold his birthright long ago. Yet when Jesus meets him, he makes sure that they come to a table. "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And when he heard this, he says, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I've come to call not the righteous, but sinners." First rabbi to ever sit and dine with him. The former Levi, now Matthew, finds his place at his table. Really interesting. In the list of the disciples in Matthew's gospel, it says these are the names of the 12 apostles. First, Simon, also known as Peter, his brother Andrew, James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John. It's the next part of the list. that we don't know a heck of a lot about. First three, yes, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas, and then he lists himself, Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus. And then would add, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, the one who betrayed him. What's really interesting to me is that if you look at the list in Mark, which probably was written about 20 years before, maybe 30 years before Matthew's gospel, and which, by the way, we are pretty positive that Matthew has the gospel of Mark open while he writes his. 88% of the gospel of Mark is found in Matthew and Luke. They both had Mark's gospel in front of them. But in this passage, in Mark 2, it says, as he passed by, in his passage of calling Matthew from the tax collector's booth, passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he says to him, follow me. In Matthew's list, he says, Matthew, the tax collector, and the next disciple he names is James, the son of Alphaeus. Still feels he doesn't belong. I betrayed my family. I betrayed my brother James long, long ago. I am no longer Levi, son of Alphaeus. I'm Matthew, son of the Republic. James is still listed in his mind as the son of Alphaeus, but Matthew, in his mind, is known as the tax collector, the worst of sinners, the publican, not a Roman citizen, not an Israeli anymore. He didn't see himself as Levi ben Alphaeus. He didn't see himself as Levi ben Yaakov. He didn't see himself as Levi ben Yitzhak. He didn't see himself no longer as Levi. Son of Abraham, the son of Isaac, the son of Jacob. It's his way of remembering. It's his way of remembering. I don't belong at this table. The only way I'm here is that Jesus invited me here. Mark sees the son of Alphaeus. Because the kingdom came calling one day. The kingdom who was at hand walks by him and says, you, follow me. Mark remembers that. Mark says, no, you're now the son of Alphaeus again. You're Levi, the son of Alphaeus. You're a child of Abraham again. Matthew says, no, I'm going to remember always that I was Matthew because he invited me here. Not because I earned this. Not because I am worthy. Proclaim the good news, he says. The kingdom of heaven has come near. He's here. We're only at this table because the kingdom comes calling. We're only at this table because he walked by our tax collecting booth and said, you, come follow. And he sets a table for us today because the kingdom came calling. Because the power to set this table is here. See, in the kingdom of this world, the powerful are at the table because they have the power to set it. They have the power to control the guest list. They have the might, they have the wealth, they have the self-righteousness. The powerful come to the table because they think they deserve it. They think they belong here. The kingdom of this world rewards people at the table. Jesus comes to set the table for those that the world leaves behind. In the kingdom of heaven, the power is already at the table. The power is not brought in by somebody powerful. It's the table that has the power. Jesus sets the table because he paid the price for everyone to be here. He surrendered his power to give the invite to us So the only way we can accept it is to accept it in our weakness, to accept it in our poverty, to accept it in our sin, to understand that we are here because we absolutely could not earn it. We absolutely are completely unworthy. Because the power is the table itself. Not really. The power is the table itself. With that one guy reclining at it who set it for us today. He exchanged it all in a transaction that did not make him powerful at all. As a matter of fact, he surrendered all power at the cross that day. And when he surrendered all his power, God gave it all back. When we surrender all of ours, he will give us the power. But remember, it's not a power exercised the way this world exercises power. We're not citizens of this world. This world is not our home. We're just a passing through. So the kingdom calls us today. The kingdom comes calling. And he is the power that sets the table for us. The kingdom's power is already here. And we've been invited.